How do you say it again?
Barragán.
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 Barragán interviewing him on behalf of Sabre. This will be used for research purposes for Sabre only. You realize that? And it's nice to meet you. I unfortunately did not come up with your minor league record, so we're going to have to go over that. But I just wanted to, I guess I start out with everyone, just kind of get an idea of what the beginning of your baseball career. I guess one of the questions I ask people is, when did you realize that, or have an inkling that you might be able to make something of a career out of baseball or playing the pro?
Yeah, people have asked me that, and I really didn't have an inkling, but going way back to elementary school, where, you know, when you realize that you throw the hardest, you run the fastest, and you're the better hitter and everybody wants to be on your team, it certainly gives you a lot of strokes, and so you continue to follow the avenue of least resistance, and you become athletically inclined. And
so okay. So then,
you know, just continuing to play in Sacramento, there was no Little League at that time. But we had in Sacramento what they called a recreation boys summer league, where they had 100-pound division, 125-pound division, and unlimited. And it was just 2 months in the summer, August and July and August. And so I played as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old in that league, in 100-pound division. So that was gratifying. And so I played in junior high school. I played baseball in junior high school and high school and junior college.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school at Sacramento High School. Yeah, I went to Sutter Junior High School and then Sacramento High School and then to Sacramento Junior College.
What was the program pretty good at Sacramento High School?
We had a championship team in 1949, and I graduated in 50, and then I went to the junior college, but I wasn't considered a prospect. I was small, and I was a catcher. I was always a catcher, even in junior high school. There was always someone better, someone bigger, stronger, and so I opted out at the junior college and went to work for a year. Came back to the junior college in 51 as a football player, because my friends had talked me into quitting my job and going back to college and play football. So we had a successful football season, and the next spring I went out for baseball and had a successful baseball season. I led the team in hitting, and I caught every game, and I played also in the summer county leagues in the Valley League for Colusa and Willows up in the Valley League. And so a lot of exposure in 52.
Now, what position did you play in football?
I was a guard and a linebacker, yeah. And we had a lot of fun. You know, that was just fun, playing football at the junior college. It wasn't like I wanted to be a pro football player or anything. And I had no aspirations of being a professional baseball player, but that going back to school was a determining, you know, that was a fork in the road. As Yogi Berra says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Exactly.
So I took it. And I was invited to go to San Francisco and work out with the Seals. And I was offered a contract with the Seals to go to Yakima to play for Dario Lodigiani.
Now, who offered you the contract?
The scout, I can't remember his name, but if you mention his name, Mickey Strader or something like that.
Who was the manager on the Seals at that time?
I think it was O'Doul.
Yeah.
I think it was O'Doul in 52. I can't remember now.
And you remember who their catcher was at that time?
Sprintz. Was it Joe Sprintz? I was really in awe.
It must have been a big thrill.
Yeah, to be invited to catch batting practice and hit some for them, you know, kind of just show off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't take the offer. I came home a little disappointed, that was the year that there was a bonus rule that you couldn't get more than $4,500 or something like that, or you had, you know, I don't remember what the details were, but they weren't offering a lot of money there. But occasionally, like a guy like Zimmerman out of the Pacific Northwest. I think he got a pretty good contract, but he had to go with the big club. You know, that was the deal. But anyway, so I came home, and Charlie Graham was the general manager for the Solons at the time, and he got wind that I had been down to San Francisco, and so he called me into his office and offered me a contract that that I took with the Sacramento.
Now, the Solons were the Sacramento team?
Sacramento Solons, and
the Pacific
Coast League, and they were independent. Charlie Graham and Dave Kelly's were the owners of the team, and so I signed in November of 62 of 52.
Let's go back real quickly. In the high school and junior college, did you play with any guys that went on? Or
In high school, I played with Woody Held. So that was something. There was something in the paper about Woody Held and Kuno Berg and two major leaguers from the same high school. That's pretty.
And you played on the same team together.
Yeah.
He? You could tell too.
He was
man of
yeah,
the boys. Kind of.
He was. He was one of our best ball players. Yeah. There were several on that ball club that signed professionally, but you know, didn't go to the big leagues. But not a lot of guys go to the big leagues.
Right.
Yeah. Even on my junior college team, there were a few that signed, maybe four or five that signed and played pro ball, but never went any further.
They get lost in the minors.
Yeah.
Okay. So 52. You're with the Sacramento Solons.
Well, I signed with them for the 53 season.
Right.
Yeah, and I went to spring training with the Pacific Coast League team at Santa Cruz, and had a good spring and showed them that I was ready to play, and they optioned me to Idaho Falls, which was their, you know, they were had a working agreement with Idaho Falls in the Pacific Coast League, and
so what was that? What would that be considered? Double A?
Class C.
Class C. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, in those days, you know, in the 50s, they had Class D,
yeah,
Class C, Class B, Class A, Double A, Triple A. There was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 leagues at that time. And now they're down to about 9 or 10 or 15 leagues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but anyway, had a good year there with Idaho Falls. I thought it was a pretty good year. Hit about 260, caught quite a few games, and great experience, you know, first year. And then, of course, after the season, I was drafted and went into the service for 2 years. So that was bad timing, because when you're 21, 22, 23, and you're spending 2 years in the service, why, it would give you two more years of experience.
But, so you went to Korea?
No, I didn't go to Korea. I was in the Navy, so I kind of stayed Naval Training Center in San Diego and played a little ball there, and then spent the second year up NAS Oakland, and I played a little bit of ball with Alameda. So it wasn't like I was in aboard ship or anything like that. So I was really lucky to do that. But they see you on your transcript that you were owned by Pacific Coast League, you know, Sacramento Solons, and so they take you out of the movement and put you into.
Now, who? I bet you played with some guys there that went on.
At NTC, there was a couple of ball players that had played, but not in the big leagues. No, none of us at that time were big league ball players. It seemed like the big league ball players were all drafted in the Army, and they were, you know, like at Fort Carson, mm-hmm. Colorado, with Billy Martin, and
right.
And Fort Ord had a lot of ball players.
Right.
But we didn't have. We didn't have any named ball players at NTC. And then I got out of the service in 55 and went to spring training with the Solons in 56 and had a good spring. And I was optioned to Amarillo, Texas in the Western League. And I played for Chuck Stevens, who was our manager. And we did very well there. That league had Lincoln in it and Pueblo, Colorado, and Sioux City,
Albuquerque,
Iowa. Albuquerque was in the league. Yeah, Albuquerque and Amarillo were the two new leagues, and two new teams, and Topeka was a new team because I think a couple of teams like Denver went to the American Association.
You want to get that?
Yeah. In Amarillo.
Was Roswell?
No, Roswell was in the West Texas, New Mexico League.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, but there were. That's an interesting league, you know, because Amarillo was new in that league, and Albuquerque was new, and it was interesting because to go from Amarillo, Texas, after a ball game to Sioux City, Iowa, like 28 hours on a Continental Trailway bus. You know,
oh my God!
You go through Kansas for a couple of days.
And what class was that?
That was A. So I'd gone from C ball to A ball, and we had a good season as a team, and I had a good year as a catcher, and so in 57, I went to spring training with the Solons and stayed with the Solons in 57. Chuck Stevens, my manager at Amarillo, was now the coach for Tommy Heath, the manager at Sacramento. So we struggled through 1957. We didn't have a very good ball club, and I didn't have a very good year. I ended up hitting 197, so that was pretty discouraging.
Why do you think that was?
Well, there were several reasons. I caught 108 games, and the other catcher that we had didn't want to catch. So Tommy Heath would come by and say, "I'm sorry, Kuno, but you're in there." And I said, "I'm sorry too, but if you can stand it, I can stand it." So I played hurt. You know, you always get a foul tip here and there, and sore arm and sore leg, and you know, plus I was playing at home. You know,
the weather probably didn't help.
Well, weather wasn't bad.
It wasn't too hot.
No, I'm in Sacramento, so that didn't ever bother me. But I didn't have a successful year. That's the main thing. And so in 58, I went to spring training and was doing okay. And they called me in to tell me that they were going to send me to Atlanta, double-A ball, for more experience. And I said, experience? I got 108 games in the Pacific Coast League and hit 197. That's a hell of a lot of experience. But they had two catchers that they wanted to keep, and they wanted to send me to Atlanta, and I didn't want to go to Atlanta, so they put me on the voluntary retired list. Yeah, and so I went to work, and about June. That was in spring training, you know, at the start of the season. They put me on the voluntary retired list, and then in about June, Tommy Heath, who had been my manager the year before, was now with Portland, and he came into town with two catchers hurt. And he asked the management whatever happened to Kuno Berrigan, and they said, "Well, he's not playing. He's voluntary retired." And they said, "Well, give me his phone number." And so he called me, and for a dollar, they made a transaction. And so he asked me if I wouldn't meet the airplane tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock because they were flying to Salt Lake and he needed a catcher. So I agreed, and I went to Portland for about 3 weeks. I played with Portland, and just until their catchers were hurt, and then they sent me back to Sacramento for their dollar exchange and went back to work.
So it was a vacation.
Yeah, it was kind of like, that was it. That was my swan song.
So you figured that was it, was with baseball.
Yeah, that was it. And so the general manager of Portland was Bill Brenner. And he became the general manager of Sacramento in 59. And he called me and he said, "Come to spring training, you can make this ball club." And so I hesitated because I'd been working now and I'd been kind of pushed around, you know, and I didn't feel like I wanted to go on. But I did go to spring training, and I had a great year, a great spring. And so the season with the Solons opened up in 59 with three catchers, Roselli, Dalrymple, and Berrigan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All of them who played in the majors, right?
Yeah. And we were all doing well, so it was pretty hard to get rid of one of them, you know. So Bobby Bregan came into town with Spokane, and he had Norm Sherry as a catcher and a young catcher named Stumpy Williams, who had a heart attack recently, you know, a week or two before that. And so he only had the one catcher. So again, he goes to the front office and says, "You got three catchers, I want one of them." So they sold me to Spokane.
This guy had a heart attack?
Yeah.
How old was he?
I don't know how old. I think they called him Stumpy Williams. He was a little guy, but he was a second string catcher to Norm Cherry. So they made a transaction, and I went to Spokane, and finished out the whole year with Spokane, and played for Bobby Bragan and Frank Howard, Tommy Davis. You know, yeah. They were Dodgers.
They were Dodgers.
Yeah, and so that was a pretty successful season for me, because I hit 260, something like that, and shared the catching with Norm Cherry, so in 60. I mean, they returned me to Sacramento at the end of the 59 season. So this is the second time I've been returned. In the 1960, I went to spring training with the Solons again, and there was two catchers that year, Bob Roselli and myself, and we both shared the catching, and I had my best year. I hit 318 for Sacramento and got drafted by the Cubs at the end of the season.
So that was your turnaround year. That was the year that really got
but you know, it's amazing how things happen. You know, in those days, if you weren't released or sold, there was something wrong, you know. But that's the way I got to the big leagues.
Did you get to interact very much with Frank Howard or
Oh yeah, yeah. Frank Howard, like? Tommy Davis, yeah, they were great. Yeah, Steve Bilko was there. Chuck Assisian was there. Tony Roark, Bobby Lillis. That was a fun. Bobby Bragan was a tough manager, but he was a good manager. I mean, he's a baseball man. And we just didn't have any pitching there at Spokane. I think we came in fourth. We had young Phil Ortega, which is a young phenom that the Dodgers had signed. We had Phil Payne. We had Connie Grob. We were just short in pitching.
Was Robin? Did Frank Howard had a lot of monster shots?
Yeah, yeah, he was awesome.
I don't know why the Dodgers traded him so early in his career.
I don't know. I think he's still coaching.
Is he?
He was
an interim coach, I think, for the Mets.
He's a wonderful guy, great personality, one of the nicest guys. You know, 6'8", giant of a baby. You know,
gentle guy. So that team must have won a lot of games.
We won a lot of games, but we didn't have any pitching, so we didn't come close to the championship at all. I think we ended up about fourth place. But we had a lot of fun, and that was a great experience for me to go to Spokane.
And you got drafted by the Cubs.
Then I got drafted by the Cubs at the end of the 60 season, and that was the last. That was the end of the franchise for Sacramento, too. They sold their franchise to Hawaii.
So were you surprised that you got drafted?
Well, I was surprised. Yeah, I had no idea that this was going to happen. I knew I was having a good year, you know, and I knew that I had a good arm and I could throw and I could handle the pitch and I could catch. But the hitting was always a question of whether you could hit. And as soon as... I guess Clarence Rowland was the scout that recommended me to the Cubs. And when they saw that I was having that kind of a year, they said this guy could play in the big leagues.
Now, did it ever come up with them as you were progressing that maybe you were older than a lot of
I was 29 when I went to the big leagues, yeah. See, yeah, that was spending those 4 years, in 57 with Sacramento, 58 a little bit with Portland, 59 with Spokane, and 60 with the Solons. But there's a lot of experience there. But because you're not with an organization, nobody sees you. You know, just the scouts that report. Right. You know, so. But that's the way it was in those days, because San Francisco was independent. You know, and Sacramento, Portland, they were all independent in the Coast League. Nobody was owned by a major league club. They all had working agreements with them. But,
right. Yeah. So you went to spring training with the
Cubs? Yeah, I went to spring training with the Cubs in 61. And
where was that?
Mesa, Arizona. No. Yeah.
Didn't they do Catalina Island for
Oh, that was before. Yeah, that was before. I think that was might have been in the 40s. Yeah, 46, 47, maybe after the war. I don't remember, but... had a great spring with the Cubs. I really enjoyed it. I got a lot of praise and a lot of, you know, boy, here we got a catcher that hit 318 in the Coast League, and he can throw and he can run, and, you know, having a great spring. And I slide into third base on an exhibition game against Cleveland and break my ankle. Yeah. So that,
what
kind
were you hitting in the spring up to that point?
Probably 315, something like that. Yeah.
You were gonna make the team.
Yeah.
I think.
Automatic. It was automatic. It was the write-up said that I was opening day catcher.
Now, was that a big? That must have been a big thrill to be on, even just during spring training.
Oh yeah.
To be in a big club. What was it? Did you notice the differences right away between the minors?
Well, I didn't. I just noticed that it was big time. You know, I mean, it was, yeah. I didn't. The pitching didn't bother me. It was just being there with guys like Banks and Williams and Sano and Zimmer, and, you know, the guys were big time. George Altman, and we had a first baseman, Ed Boucher.
Ed Boucher, Don Zimmer, Ron Zeno, Al Heiss.
Yeah, Al Heiss was there. Yeah, he had played with Sacramento the year before in 60, and he went up to the Cubs in the middle of the year.
So that set you back then.
Yeah, that set me back. I had to recuperate in Chicago while the team was playing, and the catcher that was destined to go to Houston, their AAA farm club, was Dick Bertel,
mm-hmm.
And so he stayed and had a good year, you know, because he was able to stay with the Cubs, and so I didn't participate in my first game until September 1, when they can expand their roster to 45. So I played my first game against the Giants in Wrigley Field, and my first at bat, I hit a home run off of Dick LeMay, which is my highlight of my career, I guess you might say.
Well, that puts you in the trivia books.
Yeah.
You know, who are the only players to have hit a home run, their only career home run in their first at bat.
Yeah,
I don't know how many that is.
There's 11. There was 11 guys that hit the home run the first time at bat and never hit another one. Yeah, that's. But there's about 70 or so that hit a home run the first time at bat and went on to hit more. You know.
Oh right, yeah. Covey, I think.
Yeah, well, the one was. I don't know if it was McCovey.
Will Clark.
Will Clark was one. Yeah.
But that, I know that's a trivia question.
Yeah.
Now, were you ever a power hitter? Considered a power hitter?
Not really. No, I was strictly a pull hitter, and that's where I made a lot of outs, because I tried to pull everything, you know, until I got to the big leagues, until actually in 1960 is when I learned to hit the ball the opposite way, you know, and help my average. So I became a better hitter. The more I played, the better I became as a hitter.
Now, what do you remember about that first at bat?
I don't remember a lot about it, because except that I hit the first pitch, and I thought it was going to be a base hit. I thought it was a double, and when I was getting ready to slide at second base when I saw the umpire said it was out of the ballpark, and I just started laughing.
So, what, he threw a fastball?
Yeah, it was a fastball. Yeah.
They probably had no book on you at that time.
Well, I had never faced Dick LeMay before, and that was my first at bat.
So. And what was, who you're playing, the Giants?
Giants.
At Wrigley,
yeah.
So they made a little big deal about that.
Yeah, it was a big to do, because Lou Boudreaux was in the press box, and Jack Quinlan, I guess it was, both of them were. Saying, boy, they've been waiting a long time for Cuno to get in the lineup, and anyway, it was.
Yeah, because you played 10 games, 28 at bats.
Yeah. Yeah. See, we were doing very well. We were battling the Mets for last place. The Mets beat us. They ended up in last place, with the most losses.
In the history of baseball,
yeah.
We didn't see you guys.
We were only a couple of games.
61, you were seventh, right?
Yeah.
64 and 90. Now, what happened with, how come there was four managers?
There were 12. There were 12.
In the one season?
Yes, that's
Let's hear about
That's the weirdest story that ever happened in the big leagues. I guess Mr. Wrigley in 1960, he had Charlie Grimm was the manager and Lou Boudreau, or anyway, he switched managers from the broadcast booth to the, and at the end of the season, he said that was going to be the last time he hired or fired a manager. So he was going to have a new system. It was going to go called the College of Coaches or something like that. He was going to hire 12 coaches, and he was going to have them dispersed through the system so they'd all come up with the Cubs system of play. And if a coach wasn't doing well, he would go down to AA or AAA ball, and they'd rotating coaches he was going to do. Well, believe it or not, in 1960, he had Alvin Dark as a coach. He had Jim Hagan as a coach. And both those guys went to the Giants, and then Hagan went to the Yankees. And he was stuck with Charlie Grimm, Vidi Hemsel, Rip Collins, Goldie Holt, pitching coach again, Bobby Adams, Vernal Walker. I thought I could name all 12 of them.
Harry Kraft,
yeah.
And who's this guy?
Elvin Tappy, yeah. He was the catching coach, but he didn't like the way I caught.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he and I had
a What didn't he like about it?
Well, I would get down on one knee. You know how some of these guys, like Santiago, can throw from his knees? Mm-hmm. Well, I would down to give a low target, and he said, you got to catch this way. This is the way I caught. This is the way, if you can't catch this way, you can't catch here. And I said, some unsavory remarks to him, and about, where in the hell have you been for the 9 years it took me to get here,
Did he have any experience as a catcher?
Yeah, he's a Mickey Mouse catcher.
Did he ever play
in
the pros?
He played for Los Angeles Angels in 1956.
So he's gone now, probably.
Oh, yeah, he died. Yeah, he passed away. But anyway, he was one of the catchers, and I don't particularly care for that situation. That situation was terrible. I mean, you never knew who was going to be in the lineup. When you went to the ballpark, you didn't know
who
we had. We had Dick Bertel, myself, Mo Thacker, and I think we had left-handed hitter. I can't think. Sammy Taylor. Yeah. So we'd go to the ballpark, who's going to manage? Who's managing this month? Oh, Elvin Tappy, B.D. Hemsel, Lou Klein. They all were fighting for the job, and it was like they're just.
So who did the lineup?
Whoever was the manager.
So
that
they
day.
Designated one guy in charge.
Yeah, one guy was the head coach.
And how long did how long did the average guy get that spot? Till he screwed up,
or maybe a month. Maybe if he was going good, they gave him 6 weeks. I don't know who determined it, whether it was Mr. Wrigley or whether it was a general consensus of the 12 coaches or what. But
now, wasn't there, I would imagine, there's probably a lot of backbiting among them.
There was,
bad-mouthing each other.
Yeah, but there was a lot of dissension in the ballplayers. I think the ballplayers need to have a manager that either likes you and plays you, or he doesn't like you and he doesn't play you. But when you got... I guess at any one given time, there was four coaches on the bench, the head coach and the coach at first and coach at third and the bench coach and, bullpen coach. So there was four or five of them there at one time. The rest of them were throughout the minor league system. But
did you ever see them arguing amongst themselves?
No, I don't believe we ever saw that. They would be behind closed doors, but there was just... It just wasn't a very good... Anybody that you ever talked to that played for the Cubs in 61, 62, 63 would have told you that. 63, they came in with Bob Kennedy, who was supposed to be the head coach. Mm-hmm. But
well, what's the long since 61? I wonder what the longest tenure of any Cubs coach is. I mean, they don't stay around very long, do they? I mean,
well, DeRocher stayed.
Green was there.
DeRocher stayed for.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I think he was about. Well, he was there through 69. So he must have came in 65. He was there 4 years.
That would make him a better manager for the Cubs.
Yeah. I mean, Charlie Grimm probably was he was older when I was there, but he'd been with the Cubs since 34, 36.
He played for the Yankees, right?
Charlie Grimm?
No, I'm thinking of Bob Grimm.
Yeah, Charlie Grimm was always a coach.
He
played. Oh. Yeah, I'm sure he played, and he managed. I think Charlie Grimm was the manager of the Cubs when they were in the 1945 World Series.
Mm-hmm. With the Detroit. Gabby Hartnett.
Yeah.
In the dark. Why do you think the Cubs are so cursed?
I don't think they're cursed. I just think that Mr. Wrigley at the he hasn't been the owner for some time, but so they just they didn't have pitching the year that we had Billy Williams, Ernie Banks, and Ron Santo. I mean, they had the heart of the hitting. They didn't expect Kuno Berrigan to hit 300, but do the catching job, But with the coaching system, we had replaced catchers maybe three times in the ball game, because they thought the catchers was the reason why the pitching wasn't doing well. Hmm. The pitching consisted of Hobby, Cardwell, Drott, Drabowski,
Ellsworth.
Yeah, Ellsworth was one of the, Ellsworth and Cardwell
right.
were the best. And then we acquired Barney Schultz.
He was 34.
I mean, but these guys like Drott, who were Drott and Drabowski and Jim Brewer, those were the Cub babies, that they thought were going to. God, you couldn't get a strike out of the three of them.
Now, you weren't there when Billy Martin punched Jim Brewer.
No, right? That was a year or two before. I think that was in, it had to be like 58 or 59. Yeah.
And what was your technique and strategy of handling pitchers?
I don't think that I had a particular technique. I gave him a good target, and I gave him a lot of confidence that I was going to catch the ball. I would call a pitch that I thought was the right pitch at the right time, whether the guy was stealing or not. I never had any trouble throwing anybody out. I think that I always thought that you go with the guy's best pitch for as long as you can, and they seemed to like that.
Did you scout the other players and take into account their tendencies?
Well, we have clubhouse meetings before a ball game, and if you didn't know, I didn't know any of those big leaguers at that time, but got to know them in a hurry, But in the meetings, they'd say, "Well, where do you pitch Mays?" "I don't know." "Where do you pitch Dan Musial?"
"Well, shit, low and away, yeah, high and low and away, high and inside, low
high and
away.
Tight, high and tight." But so somebody would know somebody and say, "This guy's strictly a curveball hitter or a pull hitter," and so you kind of work with that. But when you got a staff that doesn't know where they're going to put the ball anyway, so what's the difference?
Did you have any pitchers that would battle you, shake you off a lot?
No.
They pretty much go with the program?
Yeah. And I called all my own pitches, so I didn't have to look at the dugout. And I think with 9 years of experience, you should be able to set up your batter best way you know how.
Right.
But it wasn't, I'm not being critical, I'm just saying that, that was a time where we had a reliever was Anderson and right-hander.
Elston.
Yeah, I mean, they were our best, short man and middle man, but, Anderson was a hard thrower, had a good curveball, but, a little wild. Dick Drott had a great curveball, but no control. Mo Drabowski didn't come into his own until he went to Baltimore.
Geez, you're right.
Drott
walked 51 in 98 innings. That's a lot of walks.
Yeah, I mean, God, you know, it's so...
Same with Anderson walked a lot,
too. Yeah, Anderson walked a lot of guys, and it's just amazing that that you couldn't get a strike. I said that a lot of times in jest, you know, there wasn't a strike between those three guys. You call it, put a finger down, and good luck. You got to be loose because it's going to be high and tight or low and away or ground ball in the dirt. You know.
How many pass balls did you get? Let's see.
I probably had a few pass balls, but...
Well, in 61, you played 10 games, didn't make one error. Batted a fielding percentage of 1,000, made one double play.
Yeah, and we played in the Coliseum, you know, when we played in L.A. I hit off of Koufax in 61.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was a big thrill for me.
And what happened?
I got one for three.
Really?
Yeah, I have it. You can't see it. You can hardly read it, but I'm very proud of it. But the light has ruined it. I don't know whether you can see that or not, but the box score has... Berrigan, one for three, and then I was taken out as for a pinch runner. Lou Brock ran for me, Hall of Famer, runs for Kuno Berrigan. I think that's a nice little.
Yeah. Now, what was it like playing in Wrigley?
Oh, it was great. It was great playing in Wrigley. Yeah, all day games. You know, go to the ballpark at 8 o'clock in the morning, leave at 5. It's like having a job, you know.
The crowds have always seemed to be real supportive.
Not great like crowds.
The Philadelphia crowd.
Yeah, they were great crowds. And they didn't boo. They didn't boo anybody. They booed the opposition, but you know that was normal. But yeah, it was great playing in Chicago.
Who did you room with?
On the road, I roomed with Ron Santo. Yeah.
Now I was going to ask you about some of the players. What about him? Do you think it's a disservice that he's not in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I don't think it's a disservice. I think that he probably didn't get all the votes that he needed because the Cubs had never been in the World Series, never been in the playoffs, you know. And that you know, Brooks Robinson and Schmidt, you know, they were great. They have great numbers, but also they were in the limelight.
Right.
Had Ron Santo been in the World Series, he'd have been in the World Series. Yeah. I mean, in the Hall of Fame, yeah.
Well, I guess he lives in, what, Arizona now?
He lives in Arizona in the wintertime, and he lives in Chicago in the summertime.
I hear he's not doing too well. He's got diabetes.
Yeah, I saw him when they were in San Francisco. I've seen him. He's got two prostheses on his legs, and he seems to be happy about that. I mean, he's happy to be alive, you know.
Well, he admitted that he was a little upset that he didn't get... elected this last time. They had the old time record.
I talked to him, and he said that he was a little bit disappointed, but he said it doesn't bother him. It doesn't bother him. He says, you know, he says, I've got my health, you know, and I'm alive. I got my grandchildren. I ride my horse, and you know, and he's doing, and he's broadcasting for the Cubs. You know, what could be wrong with that? Yeah. You know, he's very uplifted type personality.
It's amazing because all these guys, you know, kind of have a hole in their careers because they never got to play postseason.
Yeah.
Billy Williams, right?
Yeah.
And also,
well, Billy Williams played with the A's.
Oh, that's right. He got a World
Series ring.
That's right.
Yeah.
But Ernie Banks.
Can you imagine Ernie Banks not having a World Series ring? Ron Santo. But you know, he's had a good life.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ron is that type of guy. He'll tell you right out. It bothered him for a while, but it doesn't bother him anymore.
Who were the characters on that team?
Well,
were there any wild guys, partiers?
No, I don't think so. Don Zimmer was always, we had Richie Ashburn too.
Right, I saw him.
Richie Ashburn, and
you also had Frank Thomas.
Frank Thomas, yeah, for a while, and then we traded him for a guy named Roach. He went to
Mel Roach.
Mel Roach. Yeah, we had Mel Roach. Frank Thomas went to the Braves.
What was he like?
Frank Thomas? Yeah, I didn't have much to do with him because you see that was in '61, and I wasn't really part of the club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would come to the I was rehabbing. have my foot in the whirlpool while the game was going on and stuff like that. And I got to know the friends that I wanted to get to know, and some of them that don't want to know you anyway.
Were they kind of cliquish?
No. It's just that if you're not playing, you know, you just feel like you're just
not part of the team.
And they'd go on a road trip, and I'd stay in Chicago, you know. And then when I thought I was ready to play, they said, "You can't even run. What are you talking about?" So that's why they didn't put me on the active list until September 1st.
Right.
Because they didn't want to take somebody off and put a gimp catcher.
Now, what was it that you though that what was that injury? That wasn't from the broken leg.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. From spring training. It was a reverse dislocation with a compound fracture.
Ooh, yeah. The bone actually came out of your leg.
Yeah. See up there.
Oh, look at you! Can you see the bone there?
No, because the sock. I had the sock.
Oh, yeah.
I had the.
So it bled right through the sock.
Oh, yeah.
Who's that on the ground with you?
Bubba Phillips, third baseman.
So whose fault was that?
Well,
did he hit you?
I was on second base with a double, and the pitcher, Curtis, bunted the ball, and I thought they were going to make a play at third base. And I started to slide when Elvin Tappy said, "Stay up."
Oh.
So I'd already started my slide. And
they need to be like Tommy Lasorda used to do. He would actually lay on the ground. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
that way there was no question.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it was my mistake. It was my mistake.
Oh, man, you look like you're in extreme pain.
Oh, it was just my whole career.
You probably went into shock.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was a compound fracture.
Those are serious.
Did you ever actually look at it and see the bone out of the skin?
No.
That probably would have
scared
the hell out of
you. I never took my uniform off until I got to the emergency room.
And then what is this picture at the top? It looks like somebody trying to... is that a dot?
The photographer brought that in to me, and he said, "Kuhn, I don't know whether you want this or not, but that's Daryl Spencer for the Dodgers scoring. He starts at this side here, and see, I'm inside the base path with the ball, and he comes into the base path and hits me. I'm standing straight up, practically, which is there to remind me that... You really screwed up.
Squat down where you should
have. Squat down, take the blow instead of try to pass it until.
Oh, there's the ball right next to the plate.
See, it's got a big arrow on the ball. Circle the ball.
And
the ball goes back to the backstop, and Ellsworth is the pitcher. See, so Willie Davis had hit the ball, and Daryl Spencer was on second, so he's scoring from second, and I got to go back and get the ball, throw it to Ellsworth, who takes Willie Davis out at the plate.
Oh.
I mean, it doesn't show him, but I'm running to get the ball, you see.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a nice little...
And then what's that one below where you're jumping up in the air?
That's Wally Moon scoring. That's Maury Wills and Duke Snyder. I mean, I just kept it because...
Was that the same game?
No.
Oh.
Different game.
And those were at Wrigley or at the Coliseum, do you remember?
This was... I think this was at Wrigley. I think both of them there are at Wrigley.
Do you still keep in touch with Ellsworth?
No, but
I tried to get a hold of him. He lives in Fresno.
I think he's in the real estate business.
Yeah, with Gus Zerniel and Jim Maloney all live in Fresno.
Are they all in the same real estate business?
I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, I know they were all in
Fresno. I know Gus Zerniel is the announcer for the Fresno team.
But anyway, and then in 62, with only 10 games played in 61, in 62 I went to spring training and had a great spring.
Yeah.
So I was opening day catcher for the Cubs against the Colt 45s in Houston, Texas.
In the Astrodome?
Yeah, no.
Oh, they put that old field.
Temporary field. They put it together, and right next to it was a big hole in the ground that was going to be the Astrodome.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I felt like 62 was going to be my year, even after sitting out, you know, most of 61. But again, the 12 coaches got into the situation where the catchers were shuttled back and forth.
Well, that must have been frustrating because there's probably one coach that liked you better, another coach that liked.
Charlie Metro came as one of the coaches in 62, and he liked me because he saw me play in the Coast League, and he knew what I could do, and he played me a lot. when he was manager. But see, when he was the head coach. But when he wasn't the head coach, I wasn't playing.
Right. What was Ernie Banks like? Did you get to talk
great.
To him?
Oh, great. Yeah. Ernie Banks was a pleasure to be around. A lot of guys thought he was, you know, let's play too, you know. But he was sincere.
What, too gung-ho or something?
Yeah, or, you know, like he was just playing up to the. But he really thought that was great. I feel so good. Let's play too, you know.
And how about Billy Williams?
What was Billy Williams is still a nice guy. Yeah, when he was with the Cubs as a coach, I would go down and say hello to him, and he'd come up to greet me. And he had a brother that lived here. Frank Williams lived in Sacramento, and I think when he retired, he came to Sacramento, lived, and then they asked him to be a coach, so he went back to Chicago.
Of all these guys, which ones do you keep in touch with?
Ron Santo, yeah. I he's the only one that I really communicate with. I'll call him and send him a little sympathy card, you know, when he has his leg amputated or something like that. And when he comes out to San Francisco, I call him, and Carla and I'll go see him.
So you go to a lot of games?
No, I don't go to a lot of games. I went a couple of days ago, last Saturday, I went to San Francisco to see the Marlins play, because Andy Fox is a personal friend of mine. His dad and I are good friends. Let's see, 96, 97, 98, 99, 91, 1993, yeah, 8 years. So he's done well, and he's never been a starter. You know, he's just a utility man, but he's got good skills.
Who did that painting?
That was given to me for my birthday.
Wow.
Some college girl at Chico State, friend of my wife's niece, got the baseball card. And copied it.
It looks, she did a good job. It looks just like the baseball card.
Yeah, it looked just like the baseball card.
I was trying to get, usually when I interview somebody, I try to get their baseball cards. I was trying to find your baseball cards on eBay, but.
They're on there.
There are a couple, but I mean, I wouldn't have had them at times.
So. Yeah. In fact, I signed a card that my wife took to work for a lady that works with her. And I said, where did she get these cards? These are almost perfect, you know? And they were in a little cellophane thing. And she said, she got them out of eBay. And they were about $5 or something like that, $4. I paid $15 to somebody at one of those Pacific Coast League Historical Society meetings. I have a guy that's always looking for me, you know? And if he has one, he'll...
Did they already have that this summer?
Yeah, they had it in Oakland about a week or two ago.
Oh.
Yeah.
God, I wish I would have.
Yeah. I just threw away the advertisement.
How many guys were there?
200 and something guys were there.
I wonder if my buddy, one of the first guys I ever interviewed was a guy named Dwayne Paulette.
Yeah, he was there.
He was there?
Yeah. He looks great.
He told me some great stuff.
God, white-haired gentleman. Yeah,
big guy.
Yeah. His dad pitched for Solons.
I know. Well, his dad pitched, 25 years in the Pacific Coast League. So do you have any funny stories for me?
No, I don't.
What's the funniest thing? Something funny?
Well, I have some stories, but, you know, I don't think they're funny.
Unusual,
yeah. When I was rehabbing in Chicago, and this is not, I don't think this is for publication, but I would dress and go sit in the stands. And so they came to the bright 12 coaches got together and said, hey, well, Berrigan's sitting in the stands. So one day they came and said, come with me. And they took me by the hand, and I walked up Wrigley Field, up the ladder on the outside of the ballpark, into the scoreboard, where they had set up on the tripod a 12-powered, 10-powered scope with a button, on and off switch over my right shoulder that lit up the exit sign. that would be right over the right-handed pitcher's shoulder. And that was my job.
Now that makes it. Now you've heard about how they all said now about 1951, shot heard around the world, that they were stealing signs from Jerosha's office. And but see, what always got me with that is your way makes a lot more sense because it was a direct signal to the hitter.
Yeah.
The thing that I always thought is, how the hell are they going to get that message to that hitter that quickly before the pitch is thrown?
Yeah.
But with the exit sign, yeah, that made sense.
Yeah, the exit sign was a red light that you couldn't miss. If you were looking at the pitcher, you'd see the red light go on and off.
So that means you only were telling them two pitches, either fastball or curve.
Yeah, I was just letting them know when a fastball was coming.
Oh.
There was no sign for a curveball. Mm-hmm. Just when the light flashed, it was a fastball. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty successful at it. And mm-hmm. there were days when I would come down and I'd say to a guy like Al Heist or to Zimmer or to, you know, the pros, mm-hmm. the old guys, Ashburn, they all wanted the signs. Mm-hmm. And they got two or three hits that day or something like that. And I'd say, well, we did okay today, huh? I never take those signs.
Well, a lot of guys said that even if you knew the sign, it was still not, doesn't mean you're going
to win. Oh, yeah. You know. Yeah, it doesn't mean. But
it's like that, card counting in blackjack. It doesn't mean you're going to win now every time, you know, but it increases your odds, right?
Yeah, and there were times when I would come down and I'd say, well, geez, what's going on? I'm giving you guys the signs. You guys weren't doing anything. Just somebody put a paper bag over that sign, over that light. It was Stanky? Was he the manager? Who was
Eddie Stanky?
St. Louis? Who was the manager?
I don't know back then.
Who was the manager for St. Louis in 61? I think it was Eddie Stanky, wasn't he? Anyway.
He figured it out.
Somebody figured it out, and and then when the Giants came to town one time, because Hank Sauer was with the Cubs a couple years prior to that, and he came. He wasn't the player, but he was a representative of the Giants, right? And he came up there, and the little clubhouse, the little scoreboard man, I forget his name, but anyway. When I would come up, we would put this like a railroad tie against the trap door so nobody could come up there. And Hank Sauer came pounding up there on that door. I know you're up there, you SOB. I'm coming up there. I'm going to tear you apart. The little man got so excited, you know. And so did I, but there was no way he could push that thing against it, you know.
Now, you were the score kid was up there too, right?
It was a
the
man.
The guy who was changing the
numbers. They changed those manually.
Right.
Yeah. In Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
And so he and I were the only two up there in the scoreboard.
Now, were you the only one who did that, or did they have other players do it when you were
No,
playing?
I was the only one that did it. And I don't know if they did it. They must have done it before.
Right.
Because Hank Sauer knew it. And Eddie Stanky knew it too, but that was an experience. And I hate heights, and I'd have to come down that trap door and walk down the ladder on the outside of the stadium.
The fans could probably see you going up there.
Oh yeah, well they you know they before the no ball idea. This would be before the ball game.
Yeah. I mean, did you ever have the other team, did it ever reach a point where the other team was like shaking their head going, man, they seem to be knowing what we're throwing
No.
Never that bad.
No. There was one game where I thought that they were all getting signs from me and they beat Cincinnati like 18 to, got 23 hits or something like that and won the ball game 18-6 or something. But you come down and say, boy, we really did it to them today. I never look at those signs. I never take those signs.
Now, I'm wondering, you know, back then, I mean, that was pretty sophisticated for back then. I mean, I'm wondering now what they can do with the electronics.
When Bob Buell came to the Cubs and knew what we were doing in 62, he said, that's nothing. He says, in Milwaukee, the bullpen is in right field, and those guys sit up there with their feet up on the fence. When the feet are up there, when their feet are crossed, you know, that's a fastball because they're sitting there with binoculars right there, and Buell and Burdett were the biggest cheaters on that ball club. And Spahn, when they were all out there in the bullpen. Yeah, they
I think Bob Buell holds a record for worst batting average with over 75 at bat. Something like that.
Yeah. I think he recently passed away, didn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
He's considered one of the worst hitting pitchers of all time.
Second was Joe Stanka.
Really good. Now, did you ever get into a banter with the batters or with the umpire?
I was thrown out of one ball game by Stan Landis. The umpire, she just was having a bad day, and so was I guess. But he just had enough of my bickering, so he threw me out.
And then what about with the batters? Did you talk to them? No. Try to get in their head?
No.
Did they ever talk to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was all congenial. You know, I mean, it's, hi, Kuno, how you doing? Yeah, it's kind of nice to be able to say that somebody like Stan Musial will come to the plate and say hello, Kuno. You know?
I heard they said he was the nicest guy. He would welcome all the rookies. And I remember Ernie Broglio, interviewed him.
Yeah.
And Ernie said that it was the nicest guy. No ego at all.
Yeah.
It seems like the really good ball players are so secure in themselves that they don't play those ego games. It's the marginal players, you know, like the, I remember when I was a Yankee fan, Joe Pepitone was that way, and they thought they were had bigger heads than they probably should.
Yeah, I think that most of them that I can remember were pretty nice. I never got into their heads or said anything to them other than how you doing or what's going on or how you doing.
But the benefits from when you were in the minors to when you played for the Cubs were apparent with the hotels and more money for food and the perks.
You know. The meal money was about the same. Isn't that crazy? $10 a day in the big leagues?
Wow.
In 61, 62, 63.
Well, didn't they feed you after the game?
No.
Not like they do now.
No, I tell the story a lot about Yosh Kawana was our clubhouse boy in Chicago, and we'd have a doubleheader, and we'd go in between ball games, and they'd have Campbell's pork and beans soup.
And that's it.
And crackers, saltine crackers. That was it, yeah.
I hear now that some of these spreads. Like
sushi. I've seen those spreads, yeah. Yeah, they're great.
Billy Martin used to tip those over.
And even the River Cats have a cook out there. They have a kitchen out there between the two dressing rooms. And they it's mandatory that they have a post-game buffet. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Things have sure changed in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
You were lucky if you had a hot dog.
Even in Chicago, you had to pay for that soup. You had to pay for a sandwich and he would take it. Yosh Kawana was notorious because he'd have everything on the back of an envelope.
Who ate soup?
Kuno, sandwich, and beer. And he'd mark it on his thing so that, you have to pay him at the end of the road trip or end of the homestand. He'd tell you what you owed him, and then you tipped him on top of that.
Did you have fun in the city of Chicago?
Yeah, it was fun to be in Chicago. There were a lot of places to go, and my family wasn't there because they were, in school. So they would come in June and stay till, just the end of July. I had to be back in August,
So they never, had you played 3 or 4 more years, maybe you would have to decide whether you wanted to move into Chicago.
I don't think I would ever do that. Keep them here. Yeah, but had I played another couple of years, it would have been good. I would have been able to qualify for the pension, too.
Oh, you didn't get any pension money?
No. There's a little thing going on now where there's possibly a lawsuit against the Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball to try and do something about the 1,100 ball players that are eligible, that are not eligible for the pension, but should be allowed because.
Who else was I? Oh, I interviewed a guy. You probably never heard of him. He was a catcher. He's kind of like you. He wasn't really big enough to be a catcher. Played a little bit for the Pittsburgh Pirates. His name was Jim Mangan.
Yeah, I know Jim Mangan. Jim Mangan's the catcher that didn't want to catch in 57.
What happened?
Tim, well, they got him from, he was with the Giants in like 55 or 56, and he told Leo DeRocher he was the worst manager he'd ever played for.
Oh, my God.
So he was found himself in Minneapolis.
Oh, no.
And so Tommy Heath had been the manager in Minneapolis, so Tommy Heath got him to come to Sacramento in 57, in spring training in 57.
Wow.
So he arrived with his golf clubs. Jim Mangan. If you know Jim Mangan, you can understand what I'm saying. He came there, you know, this is minor leagues. This is not for me. I'm just going to hit some golf balls. And it was time to catch. And, you know, he impressed me as a pretty good catcher. He was a pretty good hitter, you know, in the minor league. He played for Hollywood in like 54 or something like that, and then went up to the big leagues. But anyway, he decided that he wasn't going to catch. He didn't want to catch for Sacramento. So Berrigan had to catch. And one time Tommy Heath said, go warm up Earl Harris. And Mangan said, Chico Herron's down there.
Whoa, he just heated.
Tommy Heath looked to Chuck Stevens and he said, this game's taking up too much of that boy's time.
Well, it's funny when I met him because he's, you know, older now and he looks kind of gnarled in his hands. And then I looked at his picture when he was a little kid. When he was a rookie, blonde hair.
Yeah.
He looked like he could be in the movies, you know. Yeah. But I didn't know that. He didn't even want to catch.
No, he didn't want to catch.
Yeah.
So they got Lenny Neal. They picked up Lenny Neal later on in the season. I don't know what they did with Mangan. I think they just gave him an outright release.
Yeah. I remember I caught, too. I was a catcher. And my dad was a great coach. He coached Little League for like 20 years.
Yeah.
But he used to do a thing. I had a bad problem where if it was in the dirt, I'd turn my head.
Yeah.
And so he would sit there. I remember when I was Little League, and he'd throw that ball and hit the mask, keep hitting it, to let me know. But another problem is I didn't know where to situate myself behind the hitter, and I'd constantly be getting catcher's interference, where the guy would swing and hit the... That ever happened to you?
It does happen occasionally. You get too close, or the guy swings late, you know, on a ball.
Do you ever think a guy might have done that intentionally?
Well, I think in college a guy intentionally hit me in the head with a bat because I was jarring with him, and he got pissed off, and he went like that.
Wow!
You know, hit me in the back of the head. The umpire gave him a base for catcher interference.
Now, did you ever pull a Johnny Roseboro and throw the ball too close to the head? Now, is that, do you think that really happened? How could you tick a guy's ear?
I don't know. I think that's kind of blown out.
Fable.
I mean, it's possible to hit a guy when you're throwing the ball at third base. You know, the guy doesn't get out of the way, and you get up throwing. And it's possible to hit a guy throwing the ball down to second base, but it's not possible to hit a guy or throw the ball, tick his ear, throwing the ball back to the pitcher.
Right. Now, did you ever, you called the pitches, you didn't get them from the manager. Did they ever tell you to order the guy to get hit?
No.
Beamed?
No.
So that never, and did you ever get in a fight? Was there ever a fight where like somebody rushed the mound or anything?
You know, I was on the bench. There was another catcher playing that day, and it was in Milwaukee where Sano scored from third base on a wild pitch, and he and the pitcher came at the same time to home plate, and he was safe. But there was a scuffle at the home plate, and so both benches emptied, and I was in there trying to help my roommate, right, getting guys off of him, and one guy that I had around was number 44, you know, Hank Aaron.
Oh, wow. Big man.
Yeah, well, I didn't realize who he was, and he didn't say anything.
So you had Hank,
I had him in a bear hug.
Wow.
You know, and Ron Sano tells a story about that. He tells, my roommate came out and pulled Hank Aaron off of me. But,
And I was going to ask you about Lou Brock. I mean, they always talk about how, I interviewed Ernie Broglio. And he said to me, which I had never heard, that the Cardinals knew that he was kind of finished when they got rid of him. They were trying to hide the fact that he had a bad arm. And that, you know, I mean, what did you think of Lou Brock?
Oh, you mean the Cubs were trying to get rid of him? Or the Cardinals were trying to get rid of him?
Yeah, the Cardinals.
At the end of his career?
Right.
Well, yeah, probably. But he binge run for me in 61.
Oh, really?
So he came up to the Cubs at the end of the season, just like I was put on the on the 45-man roster. And then he opened the season in 62 in center field, because 62, Al Heiss went to the Colt 45s. And he wasn't the Lou Brock that we know as a Hall of Famer, you know, to steal a lot of bases. The Cubs gave up on him because they said that he had iron hands, you know, I mean, with every time he'd come in, the ball would bounce out of his hand. But they just weren't very patient with him, you know.
Did you get to talk to him?
Oh, yeah. Time? Yeah, I've gotten to be friendly with him. When he comes to Sacramento or whenever I get a chance to talk to him, he gave me his autograph, a picture up there, the very last one on the right, up there on that.
Well, you got quite a collection of stuff here. Orlando, Billy Williams. Who's these two guys? These are with you at the Soul?
That's Roger Ozenbaugh.
That's when you were playing for Sacramento?
Yeah.
Who's this Red Sox guy with the glasses?
White Sox. That's Buddy Peterson.
He looks familiar.
Yeah, he played in the Coast League.
Harry Bright with the Yanks.
And Bud Watkins, he played in the Coast League.
Oh, wow.
And Al Heiss, Richie Myers.
Wow.